This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
It was very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we'll be talking about postpartum depression, a potentially dangerous condition that leaves many women scared and isolated.
Culturally, we're taught to celebrate a new life in our homes and in our families, so it tends to be very foreign to see a mother who is supposed to be happy to be having a baby, then having these negative feelings based on how will I make it through this process? How will I get through the day with an infant? How will I make sure this infant is safe?
Also, Anna is trying to live her best life as a young cancer survivor in Tanzania.
My life is just so different now, different in a very much positive way. It's not my best life, but it's very much better than 3 years ago. And maybe I could have not been alive by now, so I'm just grateful. And I don't think if life with disability is that hard, especially when you have a good support system and you encourage yourself every day.
It's Tuesday, the 25th of February. First, we go to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Since the start of this year, vast swathes of the Democratic Republic of Congo have fallen into the hands of the Rwandan-backed M23 rebels. Rwandan troops have also invaded Congolese territory. And now, two of the largest cities in the mineral-rich east are under the control of the militia. Official Congolese figures say around 7,000 people have been killed and hundreds of thousands of others have fled or live in fear of reprisals. Countless women have been raped in this renewed offensive. Regional and international diplomatic initiatives are underway to try and stop the war. And the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Karim Khan, is in the DRC to investigate potential war crimes charges. The U.S. has announced sanctions against the former Rwandan army chief, James Kabarebe, and M23 spokesperson, James Kanyuka. You may be wondering why the DRC is at the center of a war that has been like a running sore for decades now. The answer is not simple, but it does involve the massive mineral wealth the country possesses, minerals that are crucial for the new technologies being developed today. So it is with some interest that we've been reading of a deal being proposed by President Tshisekedi. In a major scoop, the West African bureau chief for the New York Times, Ruth McLean, managed to interview the president. And he told her that he'd offered the U.S. and Europe a major stake in the wealth beneath the rich soil of the Democratic Republic of Congo. In a statement that we've read out, Tina Salama, who speaks for President Tshisekedi, spelled out the offer.
President Tshisekedi invites the USA, whose companies source strategic raw materials from Rwanda, materials that are looted from the DRC and smuggled from Rwanda, while our populations are massacred, to purchase them directly from us, the rightful owners. And it's not just for the USA. The offer is also extended to Europeans and to all parties involved in sourcing smuggled, bloodstained raw materials from Rwanda, with sanctions imposed on Rwanda and on M23 through James Kabarebe and Lawrence Kanyuka. Sourcing raw materials, also known as conflict materials, from Rwanda will become increasingly compromising and complicated.
That was a statement sent by Tina Salama, who speaks for President Tshisekedi. Mr. Tshisekedi feels that the world is not paying enough attention to the conflict. So let's unpack the deal he's offering and what he hopes to achieve by it. The thing is, the U.S. did have large mining interests in the DRC. So let's talk to someone who's been working on the Democratic Republic of Congo for years now. Jason Stearns is founder and chair of the Congo Research Group and writer of many articles and books on the DRC. We'll start our conversation with a step back. How and why did China replace the US as one of the main players in the Congolese mining sector?
The U.S. has been invested or interested in the DRC since the colonial period. Famously, the minerals for the uranium for Hiroshima and Nagasaki came from Congolese mines. And so this goes back a long way. The more recent history is that once the mining sector in the DRC was privatized, which happened in the early 2000s, American investors did get in. There were famously some very large American companies. The last one was called Freeport-McMoRan, that owned one of the largest copper and cobalt mines in the world in Katanga, in the southern south of the DRC. But they got out of that sector and sold their mine to a Chinese company about 5 or 6 years ago. And that, I think, is indicative of a broader trend where you see most Western, American, and other mining companies getting out of mining in the DRC and Chinese coming in. Most of the largest mining companies, with one or two exceptions, in the DRC are owned now by Chinese. And so this is where, in terms of GCKD offering the Americans, who, of course, more recently are now worried about the supply chains, about getting access to critical minerals like copper and cobalt, and having all of those supply chains dominated by Chinese. And so GCKD is saying, well, we can change that. We can offer you perhaps another foothold in our mining sector.
It seems to have happened very quickly and for a very short time that the Chinese have been involved in dominating the sector. How quickly would Americans come back? And indeed, in fact, are they looking to come back?
I think what the Congolese are trying to do is they're trying to appeal to the transactional nature of the new U.S. administration of Donald Trump. They need help. The M23 rebellion backed by Rwanda is quickly making headway in the eastern DRC. And I think that since they have really no army that can push them back, they need pressure from key partners like the United States. And so they're trying to figure out what the U.S. wants in return for pressuring Rwanda. And several things, I think, have been floated. And the most recent thing is giving them access to minerals. But you can't really offer the U.S. government access to minerals. The U.S. government is not going to come in and start mining and processing minerals in the DRC. Those would be private U.S. companies, and those same private U.S. companies got out of the mining sector, sold their mines to Chinese for a good reason, which is they found it difficult to work in the DRC, and the Chinese have perhaps an advantage in working in places like the DRC. And so Tshisekedi offering this to the American administration is one thing. Them actually accepting it or operationalizing that offer is an entirely different thing.
So how appetizing is this for American companies? Will they want to get back in there? Because nothing's changed. In fact, the war is even more intense than it was before.
Yeah. Potentially, I think that some mineral prices have gone up. Others are going down. The Congo announced that they were suspending cobalt exports because the price was so low. So there's a glut on the market for some products and not for others. We've seen gold mining, for example, go to astronomical heights in recent years. So it depends on which mineral we're talking about.
Tell us about the minerals.
The Congo is the largest producer of copper in Africa by a long way now. It's the largest producer of cobalt in the whole world. Copper is really the money earner of the DRC. Most of the value from the exports come from copper. Gold is a big one. I mean, most of it's artisanally mined, so pick and shovel sort of mining in the eastern DRC. And almost all of that is smuggled to neighboring countries. If the Congo could actually get a hold on the gold mining, it would be quite profitable and lucrative. It loses about $4 to $5 billion a year in gold that's just leaking out through the east of the country. And so there's a bunch of different opportunities. And Tshisekedi said, I think in very vague terms, that they were putting this on the table.
The Congolese president also had very strong words about Rwanda and Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda. He said that Rwanda wanted to be an apex predator. That seems to me the strongest criticism that he's leveled against Paul Kagame. And the U.S. has asked Rwanda to stop its involvement in this war. Do you think that there is a move towards pressuring Rwanda, and a stronger move towards pressuring Rwanda? Because Rwanda at the moment still has sort of poster child, you know, status amongst the EU
Absolutely.
Countries.
There's been a lot of very heavy language slung around by heads of state in the region. So that wasn't actually the worst it's gotten. Tshisekedi during the election campaign called Paul Kagame Hitler and said that he's going to end like Hitler. And so there's a lot of pretty nasty rhetoric.
The H word, does unleash a lot of feelings, doesn't it?
But to your question, I think that the fall of Goma and Bukavu definitely has unleashed an enormous amount of attention on what's happening in the Eastern DRC, and certainly a lot of condemnation. But at the moment, it's mostly at the level of words and statements. In some countries, it's not even words and statements. I would say, particularly amongst African countries, they've been very reluctant even to single out Rwanda, which is strange since it's fairly much, I think, demonstrated and open knowledge that Rwanda is involved in the Eastern DRC. But, you know, yes, it's true. The United States has condemned Rwanda just this past week. They imposed sanctions on one of Rwanda's very prominent figure in the Rwandan government, James Kabarebe, who's been a key figure in all of the Congo wars. And so that's something. I don't think it's going to change anything. I think what would change something is actually suspending aid to Rwanda, or if some of its major international corporate partners, I'm thinking about Arsenal, PSG, Bayern Munich, Formula One, if they started boycotting Rwanda, I think that could start moving things. They could feel the pressure. And up until now, that hasn't happened. The Europeans need to make decisions like that through consensus. Some parties are blocking, especially the French. I really don't see heavy sanctions being imposed on Rwanda. Just this weekend, for example, the American pop star John Legend performed in Rwanda, and he said he knew that there was some controversy around Rwanda, but he wanted to perform anyway because he owed it to his fans. And so I think that Rwanda has surprisingly, I think, been able to weather this storm. And that means I think they're going to continue advancing and the war is going to continue.
I suppose we should also point out that Rwanda says it doesn't command the M23, but it doesn't deny that it is inside the Democratic Republic of Congo. So given that President Tshisekedi has made this offer to the United States, what is he expecting in return? Protection?
I think, yes, exactly that. The Congolese government has now realized that their army is not able to withstand the M23. They have been defeated now again and again. Even though their army is much larger and much better resourced in terms of funding, they've been defeated again and again by the Rwandan army with the M23. And so I think they realize that their main hope for pushing back the M23 is foreign aid, foreign pressure. And that's not unreasonable given how dependent Rwanda is on its reputation and on foreign aid. So what Tshisekedi wants from the United States is that pressure. The U.S. is the largest bilateral donor to Rwanda. By far, the U.S. also has de facto veto power within the World Bank, and the World Bank has huge programs in Rwanda. And so I think if they were willing to use that pressure on Rwanda, it would actually make a difference.
Jason Stearns, founder and chair of the Congo Research Group. He's worked for many years in the Congo and was head of the UN panel of experts on the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now to something we don't pay nearly enough attention. It's postpartum depression. It's a condition that many women suffer following the birth of a baby. It's confusing because the birth of an infant is meant to be joyous. And it may well be, but it can affect the mental health of the woman who gave birth to that infant. A 2024 study published in the South African Journal of Science says postpartum depression is a significant public health concern in sub-Saharan Africa, a region where health resources are already limited. It is underreported and undiagnosed, which can lead to very dangerous situations for both mother and child. Recently, the Lusaka Times reported the case of a 26-year-old woman in Zambia who is now in jail after pleading guilty to killing her 10-day-old baby. The judge took into account the fact that she had postpartum depression and sentenced her to a 5-year prison sentence, which is the minimal sentence. But is punishment the appropriate way to deal with this illness, as extreme as its manifestations may be? I've been discussing the issues with Dr. Luanaledi Chunga, the founder of a mental health campaign, Walk With Me.
Firstly, thank you for having me. And I think it's important that we have conversations like this to reduce on stigma and just increase on people being able to access information around these illnesses. So postpartum depression is a mental illness that is associated with physiological changes of pregnancy. So usually we say that the pregnancy, the duration of the pregnancy, and at least a few months after, so anything up to a year of following the delivery, can be termed as postpartum depression. And I think it has three main tiers. So the first tier is what we call the baby blues, where we have anxiety, sadness, and worry around the circumstance of being pregnant and also the possibility of delivery, the risks involved. And then we move on into depression, which is more severe, which can be postpartum or prenatal. So you can have it during the pregnancy or after delivery. And then the most severe of the postpartum depression types is postpartum psychosis, where we have worrying behavioral changes, more severe hostility, aggression, confusion, and things like self-harm coming into a higher degree.
Do we know what causes it?
There are several things that can play into the illness coming in. So the main things we look at are pre-existing mental health conditions. If this is a mother who has an anxiety disorder that is particularly severe, if this is a mother who already has depression, if this is a mother who has a schizophrenia, and then we also look at lifestyle. Is this a mother who is stressed? Does she have social support? Are there circumstances around the pregnancy that would trigger negative feelings? So things like sexual assault resulting in pregnancy would then be something that would be considered a trigger. We also have a few things of women having difficulty adjusting to the physical demands of pregnancy. Not being able to do what you could do before can be quite depressing. And a lot of young mothers, especially, I think in this story, the mother was about 26. She was very young. It's very challenging to confront some of these changes and meet some of these demands without adequate information. And then we also have other factors like substance use, genetics, and just social environment. Is this a mother who is unemployed? Are there certain pressures she has at home that are not conducive for this pregnancy to exist?
In the case that you referred to, a 26-year-old young woman in Zambia, she's now serving a 5-year prison sentence after pleading guilty to killing her 10-day-old baby. This is extreme. Are there ways in which people can identify this earlier so that we don't reach this extreme condition and circumstance? And we'll talk about, appropriate punishment, whether somebody should be going to jail for this at all.
So we can identify certain things. I think there are symptoms in terms of depression, but I think importantly, it's to assess the kind of life this person lives. Can they afford to look after these children? Are they able to have this pregnancy safely? Are they happy with the pregnancy outcome? Are they happy whether it's a boy or a girl? A lot of these social things come in, and we as communities tend to know these things. But I think as medical professionals, a lot of the time we look at antenatal visits. So every point of contact, if you're assessing for a high-risk person for mental health, you look at, is this person persistently sad? Are they having anxieties about the pregnancy? Are they having anxieties about how people perceive them during this pregnancy? Then it escalates a little bit into the person having a lack of interest in doing things that they ordinarily would or should do. So things like self-care. Is your patient bathing every day? Are you taking care of yourself? If you see there is some form of personal neglect, you can then come in and say, these are risk factors that are now becoming symptoms that we can look at and then start to assist in ways that we see appropriate. There are also things like low self-esteem, disturbances in sleep, poor appetite, increasing irritability, self-blame, and feelings of humiliation associated with the pregnancy.
And I'm also wondering how social attitudes and expectations factor into this, because everybody expects you to be really happy when you've had a baby. You know, it's meant to be a joyous occasion. So for somebody to turn around and say, well, actually, I don't feel joyous. I feel overwhelmed and anxious. And people tend not to share these experiences either, right? So other women won't necessarily want to acknowledge that this has happened to them as well, and that this might be quite a normal process or a normal set of feelings that somebody's going through.
Culturally, we're taught to celebrate a new life in our homes and in our families. So it tends to be very foreign to see a mother who is supposed to be happy to be having a baby, then having these negative feelings based on how will I make it through this process? How will I get through the day with an infant? How will I make sure this infant is safe?
And feeling that, well, other people have done it and women have done it since time immemorial, so there must be something wrong with me if I can't do it.
It's looked down on if you are not excited. And a lot of the time that really feeds into the inability to speak up and say there is a problem and I need help.
So what treatment is available?
So the first is usually talk therapy. Some countries like South Africa, and I know some countries like Kenya, tend to have support groups for new mothers in the antenatal clinics, in the internet antenatal space. We have places where mothers can go before they deliver to do aerobics. Those are safe places and safe communities for mothers to speak out and have those conversations. Psychotherapy, if necessary, as well as cognitive behavioral therapy. Beyond that, if the problem is persisting, then we can now escalate to medical interventions, which can vary depending on your symptoms and the severity of them.
Let's talk about this particular case. 5 years in jail. The judge recognized the circumstances, the postpartum depression, and said she was liable for a simple sentence of 5 years. Now, 5 years in jail, any way you cut it, is not a simple sentence. Is jail appropriate in this case? And for women who clearly need help rather than punishment?
I know it tends to be a very sensitive topic because a child's life was involved, but I think somebody who needs help should not be solely in a prison. I think they should be isolated because they might be a danger to others or to themselves. But I'm really for the idea that she should be in a mental health facility, assisting her constantly and assisting her in managing this mental illness. Because a lot of the times, I think sometimes our prisons are not really well equipped to handle mental health conditions. And if we're hoping she will go through some form of rehabilitation, we want the mental health aspect to really come in and really speak to her condition and the context in which the crime happened.
What about government reaction? Do you think that it made people in the health ministry in Zambia sit up and think, we really need to pay attention to this because this is a tragedy?
I don't think so. I think mental health in many of our countries tend to be a bit neglected. They don't get the attention they deserve. For me to even just come across this story, I actually was just browsing a newspaper and it happened to catch my attention and I read it to the end. But I don't think it's getting the kind of reach that it should.
You know, I know this is an extreme case, but in the work that you do, how often do you come across women who are actually really struggling with postpartum depression and the other forms of mental illness that derive from their pregnancies and the situations in which they find themselves?
Some of the urban health facilities were reporting numbers as high as 26% of pregnant mothers were suffering from some form of postpartum or prenatal depression. Based on Walk With Me Foundation, we do have a postnatal depression support group. And I think we have around 25 mothers who were actually trying to get through the day-to-day of postnatal depression and just seeking that support. It's a peer support group, but we do have one that mothers tend to reach out once in a while to have conversations around. Is this really normal? Is this something I should be worried about? And we do offer reassurance and then offer information around escalation if needed.
That's Dr. Luanaledi Chunga, founder of a mental health campaign, Walk With Me, in Zambia. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
It was very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Young people have been diagnosed with cancer in greater numbers in recent years. Anna Kalwe from Tanzania is one of them. She was diagnosed with rhabdomyosarcoma, which is a rare form of cancer that affects the soft tissue in our bodies. We'll be discussing the reasons why so many young people are getting cancer in a moment, but let's follow Anna into the illness that nearly cost her her life. She tried everything to heal herself, including prayer, fasting, and traditional medicine. It didn't help. After nearly a year of suffering, she was faced with the decision to undergo an amputation. I've been talking to Anna about what led her and her parents to that decision and how she came out on the other side as a social media influencer and champion for disability rights.
I was having very rapid weight loss, pain, fatigue all the time, even in the morning where I've not done anything. I was just pale. I was having just random diseases, like someone who has malaria or something. You're just constantly sick.
And in the course of trying to find treatment and trying to find answers, you didn't just use conventional medical means, right? Tell us what other means you used to try and find a diagnosis and find treatment for yourself.
While trying to find diagnosis, I was only using the hospital means. But after diagnosed with cancer, then we started looking for alternatives that would have made me not to pass through amputation. So we had to go to the churches, different religions, and also traditional medicines, traditional doctors. Yeah, I was just taking everything that is brought in front of me that people believe that when I take it, it can cure my cancer without getting amputated.
So I imagine that would have involved a lot of prayer, but what else? What other kinds of remedies? What form would that have taken? Things that you have to drink, like teas or something?
Some of them were just using herbs and roots of trees. Some of them were just using beliefs. They just told me maybe someone gave me the disease, so I should try to find the person so as I can say sorry to him and I get cured. So I have been through different doctors, which everyone had his or her own way of treatment.
So what finally led to you having to take the decision? And I imagine because you were so young, your family were involved in that as well. What finally persuaded you that there was nothing that was going to help you? Amputation was the only way to go.
The doctor that was treating me at that time, after seeing like the development was not well, I had no good prognosis. So he said that he thinks I have cervical cancer because he believes that all cancer starts from the cervix, all cancers in women. So he told me that he should take his own test to check if I have cervical cancer and at which stage, which I did not agree to be exposed to him in the ways he wanted so as he can check for my reproductive health. So at that point, I just told my dad, you should just go to the hospital. Me, I'm just ready for amputation. I cannot go through all this. It has been almost 7 months and I don't see any development and I'm just getting sick day by day. So it reached a point I had a lot of medical conditions like my heart diseases. I was having seizures and I was just on and off the hospitals, but not the highest hospital, like these dispensaries and small hospitals with the ambulances. I just told my dad, we should just cut all this thing. Let me just go to the referral hospital in Kilimanjaro and let me just get amputated.
So yeah. It was your decision?
Yeah, it was my decision and I was just not so much well. I was taken to the hospital with an ambulance while I was just very much in bad condition.
So it was a sort of emergency, but also you had reached the end point of all the treatment because you just felt so sick. It was almost like a last resort, but you felt that that was the only option you had.
Yeah, I had already accepted even the results of amputation. I was looking up to the internet about people with amputations and sorts, and their stories were like nice. So they were giving me like hope that when I get amputated, I'll just be okay. So I was telling my parents, this will be a good idea. This is a good idea. Until they said, okay, we can just go to the hospital. Let's not keep listening to these traditional doctors.
Do you think it was a good idea now?
Yeah. It's very much worth it.
Why do you say that it's worth it now? We're looking at 3 years later, right?
Yes. My life is just so different now, different in a very much positive way. It's not my best life, but it's very much better than 3 years ago. The 1 year of going on and off to the hospitals and the tumor in my leg and all that pain, I think this is much worth it than living that life. And maybe I could have not been alive by now. So I'm just grateful. And I don't think if life with disability is that hard, especially when you have a good support system and you just believe in God and you have just your own, you encourage yourself every day. So I think this is such a good life. Any cancer is like, it's just traumatizing.
Yeah. But tell me, in the after you went through the amputation and you came to, and the first few months that you had to deal with it, for those of us listening, what were some of the challenges, emotional and physical, that you faced? You were now without one leg and having to get used to life like that.
I think one of the challenges was just, you know, the stares, like people staring at you. It was just not sitting comfortable with me. And my family was like, don't wear trousers because you have to cut them on the one side and people will be looking at you so much. And I wanted to just live my free life because I know where I'm coming from. So the conflicts here and then, don't do this while I'm trying to prove to them that I can do this. I think that was a little bit challenging to me, but so far we're just trying to cope, me and my family and my support system, we're just trying to cope as time goes on. Now we can all listen to each other and my life is just like stable.
So what did you say to people who were looking at you and staring at you? Did you respond or did you feel like you owed them an explanation?
Even before amputation and cancer life, I'm just that person who don't explain myself too much. I just live my life. So I learned it in a very hard way to be bold with myself. So when someone stares at me so much, I just stare at him back too, because why are you looking at me? I'm just like you. What if I try to look at you in those all of those seconds? How will you feel? So yeah, I don't explain to nobody.
Right. I like that attitude. You've taken to advocacy.
Right now I am advocating for all sick people, let me say all, because I've been trying even to look up to other diseases and talk to a lot of patients. As long as you are going through something, maybe in a sickness, also children with cancer and people with disabilities too.
You do that on social media. What's the message that you convey to people?
I myself, I am a message. Sometimes I write nothing or I speak nothing. I just post myself. It is just a symbol of victory and hope and everything positive. But when I want to speak, I usually try to create awareness on types of cancers, types of disabilities, how to live with people with cancer, treatment to cancer, and sometimes just giving hope to everyone and trying to explain to people with no disabilities or cancer how to live with people who have disabilities and cancer or any types of diseases.
So for people who don't know how to deal with people who are sick, people with visible disabilities, what would you say is the one thing that we need to do in order to make it easier for all of us to live together?
How people cope to disabilities or diseases differ from one person to another. So I think there is no common principles to what you should do or how you should live with us, but try to listen and maybe read the environment we are in. Like something you'd not wish to be done to you, just don't try to do it to someone else. And also, you should always be kind. You don't know what it takes to someone to get that courage and go out, live their life. So you should just be kind, speak nice words, and reduce staring. And maybe you should just not be in those people's business too much. If you can help somewhere, just help. But let people live their life.
That's very useful to know, actually. I don't know if you saw the NFL halftime performance by Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah, I saw it.
Okay.
Just half of it.
Now, you know the crip walk that Serena did?
Yes.
Do you know that there was a black man in the U.S.? He was a amputee. So if you Google it, Google origins of the crip walk, you'll see that it's a man who is visibly disabled doing that dance with one leg and one arm. Did you know that?
Oh, no. No.
Check it out.
I will. Right now?
Yeah, just Google origins of the crip walk.
Okay. Let me see. Crip walk origin.
Yeah.
Oh.
Are you looking?
Serena Williams performed the crip walk at the Super Bowl.
Can you see the man? It's a black and white clip.
Yeah.
Can you see it?
Yeah, yeah. The man had one leg and one arm in a suit.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and he's tall.
Yeah, very tall. Is this a black man?
Yes.
Okay.
Isn't it amazing? Can you see him dancing?
Yeah, I can see him with one crutch. Then he threw the crutch. Oh, nice.
Very nice. Eh? It's amazing. I mean, I was blown away when I found that out.
It's amazing. I'm just looking at it right now.
Anyway, Anna, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you too.
Now, as promised, Dr. Catherine Nyongesa, an oncologist or cancer specialist based in Kenya.
It's unfortunate for this young patient getting this cancer of the soft tissues. And we suspect from the literature, most of it could be due to some mutation. And these are chromosomal abnormalities that the patient could have inherited unknowingly, and there's nothing you can do about them. And also probably now environmental and immune factors could come into play. But having said that, there's a lot of lack of awareness. Like, people are not aware about the warning signs of cancer. And secondly, cancer is one of the biggest mimicker. So it mimics other common ailments. And we said in our community, infection is number one. So patients will be treated for infections, cellulitis, an abscess or a boil, when actually it is a cancer. And then we also do have financial barriers. The cost of maybe care is high. They cannot afford private health care. So some of them resort to cultural and traditional interventions to see if they can help. But we know that the treatment of cancer is evidence-based, and if we look at the research that has been done, traditional healing does not cure cancer. It is always good to follow the recommended guidelines. We follow the European guidelines where they recommend, like, for example, the treatment is multidisciplinary, so you'll have to involve a surgeon, an oncologist. You may have to involve the nutritionist, the counselor, the psychologist, the radiologist, so that people come together and discuss and give the best way forward depending on the stage of the cancer, the type of the cancer, because every cancer is treated differently. I don't recommend a patient seeking traditional treatment because I don't have much evidence about that, whether it treats cancer, but obviously conventional treatment should be the way to go. Patients should seek healthcare in medical accredited medical facilities.
But we know that a lot of people don't get the right treatment. It's beyond the reach of most of the people that we're talking about across the continent. I'm wondering whether money is the only reason why people go to traditional healers, or can it also be that they don't trust the medical services, or they don't have access to those medical services either, and also just that they don't see good outcomes from people who've gone to the hospital?
It's a combination of factors: financial, infrastructural, cultural beliefs, and access. And because of what we are seeing, patients may be coming in late stages, so they will see, like, okay, so and so had cancer. They may not know the stage, but because of this delay in diagnosis, or probably cancer being one of the biggest mimicker, they arrive early to the healthcare facilities. But because probably also the healthcare personnel who is there is not so much aware. And due to those kind of barriers, patients are presenting late. And when people see, oh, so-and-so went to hospital and they did not make it, so they lose the trust.
Dr. Catherine Nyongesa, an oncologist or cancer specialist from Kenya. Focus on Africa was created by Nyasha Michelle, Sunita Nahar, and Patricia Whitehorn here in London. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist in charge of quality and quantity. Gabriel O'Regan was the technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudhengi are our editors. By the way, our sister podcast, Africa Daily, is tackling a distressing story in the latest edition. Alan Kasuja and the team are talking to people who've been affected by one of the worst atrocities of the current war in the DRC.
It's the incident just about a month ago when more than 100 women and children trapped in a prison were raped and then set alight. Alan talks to Lumumba, whose aunt died in the fire, and also Mwanyisio, an activist who was in the jail at the time of that fire. It's not an easy listen, so please do take care. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
It was very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.